Today's topic, does corporate support of universities threaten academic freedom? Today's public universities in Canada and across the globe are intended to serve the public interest. While public universities in Canada are funded by provincial and federal governments, freedom in determining teaching, curriculum, and research shielded the institutions from dictates of government and private interests. This situation seems to be changing, and the speakers will discuss the challenges of commercialization of Canada's universities and some of the methods that are employed to prevent excess influence. Our format is a little different today. We have three speakers rather than one, all of whom are professors at the U of L, which makes me wonder about my sanity in ensuring that three academics can keep to 30-minute presentation. I have great faith. I'm going to be very short with my introductions so that they have more time to talk. Dr. Ian McKenna is an associate professor in Faculty of Management, teaches courses on law and management, law and corporations, and industrial relations, and has been very active with the Canadian Association of University Teachers, which is the faculty association part. Dr. Andrew Haken is the Vice President Academic at the University of Lethbridge, professor in the Chemistry Department and former chair of the Chemistry Department, member of the Royal Society of Chemistry, and his PhD is from the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom. Dr. James Byrne is a multidisciplinary scientist and associate professor at the U of L with training in earth and atmospheric sciences and engineering hydrology. His main interest is water, and he was the lead scientist and producer for an award-winning Global Change three-part television series. So without any further comments, I would ask you to welcome our three speakers, and I believe Ian is going to speak first.
So, public universities are creations of government, they're creations of legislation to serve the public interest. There was early influence, of course, from churches and so on, and governments as to what universities would do, but that's where academic freedom and tenure and so on come in to help to sort of protect universities and faculty against the sort of the vagaries of government. Now, corporations are also creations of legislation, also originally for the public interest. The idea was that corporations were good for raising money, you know, for infrastructure, you know, to build bridges or, have ferries or things like that. And it was an extremely good way of raising capital. And so one could argue, yeah, the public interest is also served by corporations. And that was certainly true in their origins, you know, in the United States and Canada in the 19th century. Things have changed, though, with regard to corporations. In the old days, once you had done your work, you know, once you had built the bridge, the corporation died, okay? It was gone. Now, of course, corporations don't die, or they needn't die. They can be around for as long as they want to be. They're also persons, you know, so they can own property. They're protected by the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and so on. And again, presumably this is because we think it's in the public interest to give these powers and these rights to those corporations. However, one big change is that the duty, and this is a legal duty that judges require, is that corporations' duty is solely to the shareholders. There's nothing in the law regarding the public interest whatsoever. One may assume that there's going to be a public interest in the activities of corporations, but the important thing for corporations, the sole thing, is the shareholders, the benefit of the shareholders. And that is different from the university, the public university certainly, which is the general interest, the interest of the public interest. And that is where I think all three of us are agreed that there is a potential problem here. There are actual problems, potential problems, and hopefully we'll be able to debate on how we might deal with those particular problems. I'm sorry, I'm have got this cold. So now, why do we have this going on anyway? Well, it's very clear, and the literature is quite bountiful on this, is that the reason we need corporations now in universities, or appear to need them, is that governments have cut back funding. So that public funding is has been reduced substantially and considerably. So governments are encouraging, of course, then universities and professors and so on to get partners, to get research partners. And more often than not, these are the fairly large corporations, the drug companies, etc. So when these two come together, then there are potential problems. There are other differences with regard to corporations. The structure is different from universities. Corporations are structured feudally. This is feudalism. Feudalism never went away. We have basically a system in corporations that a tiny number of elite people make the decision for corporations. The subprime mortgages are great examples of that, where people's money simply evaporated because a CEO, the four CEOs and the particular ones, made the decision that they'd go to the casino and say, hey, we'll maybe make huge amounts of money, higher quarterly profits, that's more money for us. And hey, if it doesn't work out, well, we get fired, but we have a couple of $100 million, which was the case with those, as a golden handshake as they leave. So that is the kind of feudal sort of notion, and everything is from top down. Universities, certainly as they were perceived, and I don't know the extent to which we keep that, has a collegial structure where we have decentralization of authority, where we have academic freedom. We have the right to criticize the academic vice president and him, us, you know, provided it is done within the reasonable limits and so on. And these are fairly alien, of course, to the corporation. And so the whole sort of context, if you like, for a corporation changes, that they are dealing with a different breed. So that is, I think, just the attempt to give you the context of this. What I wanted to do in the obviously limited time was perhaps just to, perhaps this is old hat for you, because the cases I'm giving are late 90s, early 2000, to give you examples of the sort of problems that happened in various North American universities, some United States, some Canada, and you may be familiar with some of them. One example, Betty Dong, University of California at San Francisco, had been assigned a project of determining whether Synthoid, which was a particular drug that was used, was any better in terms of safety and effectiveness than a generic drug. She found that they were the same, that the Synthoid was not better than a generic. That is not what Boots, you know, the chemist, wanted to hear. And so we had threatened lawsuits, an order to pull her article from the Journal of the American Medical Association, and general intimidation. Why? Well, because the interests were different. Her interest was informing the public. The corporate interest is making profit, and that's a fairly simple sort of example of that particular case. Other ones, without going on too long about them, but another American one, David Kern, Dr. David Kern, occupational health physician at Brown University, did a study that showed microfibers, which spend a lot of money and donated a lot of money to the university, that microfibers employees were substantially more susceptible to lung disease than the average, than the national average. What happened there? He was fired by Brown, because and the whole program was the occupational health program was ended because again the university was beholden to microfibers and those things. If we want homegrown ones, the Nancy Olivieri case you may well have heard of with regard to Apotex. And in that case, you know, some of the relevant facts Well, without her knowing it at the time, Apotex was negotiating with the University of Toronto for a donation of $25 million into the program that was being negotiated. So it was a bit sort of bad timing when she blew the whistle on the particular drug that was being made to indicate that there were serious side effects. Deferiprone was the drug. As soon as she did that, the university did essentially nothing to back her up for the, I would suggest, the obvious reason that they want this $25 million. Eventually, the faculty association took her case. And again, the reaction of the corporation was very much one of blame the faculty member and discredit the faculty member and that kind of stuff. And so these are some of the dangers that we have. How many minutes? How many left? 2 minutes left. My gosh, time flies. Okay. So I won't go too much longer on these. Just to give you, though, an example of these as being, you know, extremely important concerns that we must have to find ways of, on the one hand, getting sufficient research money and so on, but on the other hand, serving the public interest. I guess the final sort of question I have is that universities, in my view, are part of the democratic system. Okay. In other words, they have their these privileges and so on because it helps to prevent government dictating, you know, getting out of the communist state. Trade unions are part of that. The media are part of that. And if you look fairly closely, you will see that in every one of those parts of our democracy, who's there as part of it? The corporations in all of those. And that is a really serious issue for us, a broader issue that we have to deal with. But I don't have time to do that. I'm going to step down and let my colleagues take over here.
Thank you, Ian, for your comments. You made some really good points. Corporatization of universities has been around and debated and argued and worried over ever since universities and corporations first got wind of each other.
Can you speak into the mic?
I can. I'm going to ask today about three questions. And the first one will be balance, is an attempt to try and balance and preserve universities and what they do in academic freedom. Why are corporations interested in academia? That's the question. And for years, that interest has really come from a central point. Universities are a source of disinterested knowledge. And I don't mean that they don't care what's going on. I mean that there's nothing at stake that decides upon the decision of the research, that decides where it's going to go. Why are corporations interested? It's for that very reason, that universities come at problems from a level of disinterest. And it stands them apart from the driving force behind many corporations. That freedom of the academy is the key point here. That ability to say, no, my research does not support your product. My research, in fact, says it should be removed from the shelves. Is a very important piece of what academia is all about. And I want to read you a statement of philosophy. And this is on the website, actually my website, as VP Academic at the university. And I think it's a very important one that any academic makes. And I've held this true throughout my career. The statement is the following. The university asserts its rights and responsibility for free expression and communication of ideas. It is self-evident that a university cannot function without complete autonomy in this domain. That is a central message. And I think it's a very important point to get across. One of the other comments I'll come to now, my second point, is what is the role of the academy in trying to maneuver through government wishes? We're publicly funded, and we can never forget that. There have been decreases in funding in key areas, but the costs of operating a university have gone up. In fact, the government, any government people here would argue that in the last few years, the university has seen 6% increases in its base operating grant. And that base operating grant doesn't just mean putting on classes. We get tuition as well, of course, from the students. It means funding all of the other things that universities do, including a level of research. However, when you work with governments, there's a natural tendency for governments to try and direct institutions to do what they believe is the public good for a province. And it's a very fine line as an academy that we have to walk with these things. For example, if you have a provincial government that believes research in three or four key areas is the way to go, and that they will use the funds available to direct the universities to do these things, what should our stance be? My response to this is, yes, those areas are interesting, and there are some of my colleagues that will work in that direction, but do not put all of your eggs in one basket. At the moment, science is king of the heap in Alberta. There's no doubt about it. In fact, it's a general statement about research and institutions across the country. Science attracts more funding than anything else. This government, in particular at the moment, is very focused on energy. It's focused on issues in the health care region as well. What we have to say is, yes, those are very important problems, and the persons we have will direct the efforts towards those. But on top of that, you must look at the other areas, the social sciences and the humanities. And my role as VP Academic is to make sure that all boats in the institutions rise on a high tide. Everybody gets the benefit of wealth, not just key areas that have got special interest from the government. There are also comments one could make with respect to the programming at an institution. Programming and the courses we offer are our absolute soul in a university. That is what makes us different. The way we translate the knowledge that we find out from our research into our courses, the areas that we put on programs, that's what defines a university. There are pressures to only offer certain types of programs in only certain areas, and that certain programs in these areas will be funded, whereas other programs in maybe not so popular areas will not be funded. My rule is always to remind of the public good. You can build an economy on key strengths, but you will always need everyone else to pull to the front if we truly are going to have a knowledge economy. And that's the bottom line. You still need people in the social sciences, working in the healthcare regions, doing the social sciences part, working in the humanities, working in the arts, doing that creative endeavor. Otherwise, I'm sorry, you do not have a knowledge economy. So putting these arguments out and basically stating that universities do not produce widgets is a very important statement. We are there to look at the overall forward motion of society. And when we forget that and we become highly focused, I believe the academy in particular is in threat. Having said that, there are some things we've learned from corporations. And it would be amiss not to mention them. One of the things we know and we accept is that in doing our research in institutions, we accept public funds. And I'm going to basically limit my discussion here to the sciences. But we accept taxpayers' money in order to do our research. And the universities in the past, in some instances, have not been that good at returning that investment. What we've learned, and it's been a slow process for universities because we're scientists for the most part, we're social scientists, we're humanists, we're artists. We're not really interested in forming companies and commercializing stuff, but we're beginning to learn that there is benefit in that. It is benefit in it because it returns to the public purse the value from our research. But one thing you should know is that when individuals do research at a university, the intellectual property is theirs. What they do with it is their decision. I don't work in a university where we go to people and say, you will commercialize that product. This is the researcher's decision. And that is very, very important. But what we've done is to put in place the mechanisms by which, if an individual wants to go forward with commercialization, there are mechanisms to work through. We have a technology transfer office that will assist researchers with things like patenting or licensing or even going as far as a startup company. But it all comes from the wishes of the researcher. Another area that we've learned that we need to move forward in, and we've learned from corporations, are the ways in which we present ourselves. A term for that is marketing or branding. And I don't like the latter term, branding, very much, because every time I think of branding, I think naturally that people want to talk about a catchphrase for an institution, and that's not what we're about. What I'm talking about is a way in which we connect with the communities in which we're engaged in. What is the value proposition that our university puts forward? That is what we're trying to put forward. And it comes from analyzing what we do in terms of what are our traits as an institution, what are the advantages that we have, and what is the promise that we give back to people? What do we deliver on? But the branding piece is, as I say, it's a word I'm not that happy with, but we do have to make sure that we are connecting and that we can sell that connection. Post-secondary is a very, very highly fought after area at the moment in this province. There's a lot going on in the post-secondary sector in terms of competition. And unfortunately, the demographics or the number of students out there are not in anybody's favor. I'm very selfish. I need to grow my institution to the point where we're sustainable and we're doing what we need for Southern Alberta, in fact, Alberta in general. I want the students to come to the University of Lethbridge, and I will find ways to bring them there. So I know I need to have this marketing, branding plan, but it is all about connection. And finally, with respect to what we've learned from corporations, even though there has been money for capital projects, even though there has been increases in the base grant to the institution, money into capital projects has not been what it should have been for us to grow in the manner that this community demands and that our students demand. Our hand has been tipped to look for corporate partners in many of the new buildings that we've put up. First Choice Savings Centre for Sport and Wellness is a classic example. Without that donation from First Choice Savings and Credit Union, we wouldn't have made our targets of being able to complete that building, which is a marvelous building that really looks to the needs of the community, as well as to the university. But how do we go about finding those partners? We don't. Well, I need to put some sort of myth society here. We don't just go out and accept anything. What we do in these big sort of requests is we actively pursue people and corporations who have the same ethical guidelines as we have as an institution. And that's a tough one. They have to be on the same path. First Choice was a very important corporate donor to us to get that community centre going. Why? Because their mentality is all about community. Yes, they're a credit union, but they're not a bank. And that's important. Their philosophy is a lot different than that of a bank. They're not into profit. They try and give that out. They're into minimizing the profit in order to make sure that people are well served. That's what we do. The whole thing about building community, that's what we do at the university as well. So you take a lot of time and effort to try and find these corporate partners. And when it works well. But unfortunately, when you look across the country, there have been many instances when such large donations have gone awry. And that is what causes academics to get really bent out of shape. And don't be fooled. Although I'm a member of administration, I am primarily an academic. That's how I was trained. I love the academy for what it allowed me to do, which was basically to give me the freedom to do my research without involvement or perhaps pressures from other corporations. That freedom is one of the most precious things about academia. Thank you very much.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I guess it is afternoon. Can you hear me okay now? Everybody can hear me all right in the back? Okay. one of the things being third now, I'm madly making mental notes in terms of what I should cross out that my two colleagues and friends just covered. And certainly they did cover quite a few of the points that I was going to bring forward. I'm going to come out a little different, though, because I'm kind of left-wing. You know, I'm an environmentalist. I believe in those type of things. And some people say I'm so far left-wing that I've gone right around the globe and I come back at those corporations from the right. My dad used to look at me sometimes and say, "What's your strategy?" And I thought that was a great twist, and my dad loved to twist words. And I still use that now, I think, on my kids. You know, what's your strategy? Society at this point, in terms of the involvement, and I certainly don't mean to discount anything my colleagues have said. I think Andy's a newer vice president, and I really appreciate the directions he's taking us and working on us. But generally, in society, in government, the pressure, clearly a corporate interest, right, in the background there. Andy is working hard to keep us on the straight and narrow, I believe, but society has a strategy for advanced education, for post-secondary education, for universities. And it does involve large corporate involvement in the universities. And I don't like that. I'm disappointed in that. And as Ian said, there's places where corporations are getting much too much say in post-secondary education. And I'm going to give you some examples. I do think it's totally inappropriate, my personal opinion, that we have to raise money to build basic buildings in this fantastically rich province. I appreciate those donations, but I think it's totally inappropriate. Those donations should be used for things better than bricks and mortar. That's inappropriate. We have scholarships from corporations. That's much appreciated. We have corporate involvement in research programs. I believe we had corporate involvement in research programs not only to fund research programs, but to ensure in some cases that research programs are not funded. And I think that's inappropriate. I'll give you some examples of that in a few minutes. Most of our research funding programs now are oriented to corporate matching funds. I find that particularly ineffective as an environmental scientist. Very few corporations want to fund what I do. I do climate change. Believe me, that's not in the interest of many corporations out there right now. In fact, those corporations go so far, and it's been well documented, and any of you who follow documentaries on television, good documentaries, know there's been elaborate funding programs to fund think tanks and alternative viewpoints on climate change. When climate change in the science community is absolutely, categorically a done deal, we know it's happening, we know it's happening fast, and we know things need to happen, and corporations still, and governments pick up on, you know, the statement that, oh no, climate change is, well, you know, the agenda, the corporate agenda or the science agenda, they don't know. The scientists are debating. No, we're not. We haven't been debating since 1995, for the most part. But there's been an active program to not fund climate change research, to not fund climate change researchers, to actively fund climate change researchers who claim they're climate scientists and say that that climate change is not an issue. Matching programs then, these matching programs that corporations have pushed. You know, I'm disappointed in them. There's too little amount of money around for actually doing public interest work. Right now, and I'll use an example from someone very close to me, colleagues that do climate change research. They applied to the National Science and Natural Science and Engineering Research Council for money. They applied to a program where they were told the chance of being funded is 1 in 10. This was critical climate change research. With a corporate partner, that funding, that project was moved into another pool where the chance of funding was 4 in 5. Same work that had to be done, and it was being funded. You know, it stood very little chance of being funded in an extremely competitive, non-corporate, you know, driven environment, and then it reached the 80% approval rate and went into that other program and was funded. So, you know, our entire funding of the research agenda, and is there a corporate agenda in that, I think has been stilted very heavily. Now, Ian made some comments on the corporation. The corporation has a self-interest, a profit, and they want us to do as much work for them as possible, and that's certainly appropriate. It may be that the community, it may be that you folks, it may be that other folks, it may be that society has lost track of just how much we should be watching what's going on in post-secondary education and keeping track of how much money is going to corporate agenda and how much money is going to deal with the public good. So now if I get a little disjointed, it's because I'm trying to drop out some of the things that my colleagues talked about. So now I'm going to take it even a step further, and I'm also the one that, because I'm out there and I can have fun, and you know, Andy's got to walk a lot of lines, and I admire him for it, and I don't want his job. I've seen his job, and I don't want his job. Owen Holmes will probably back me on that now. You know, I don't have to walk those narrow lines, and I can say that it's even gone many steps further. When you can't get a university to say what you want them to say, then start your own think tank. And there's think tanks all over the place. Think tanks that do the work for corporate agendas, and they're funded by corporations, and they're presented as legitimate research agencies, and they're not. I think we should tank think tanks. I think they should be illegal. I don't think, you know what, I'd like to see Andy watching over any think tank that exists in southern Alberta. I'd like to see UBC looking over any think tank, not to mention the Fraser Institute, of course, but, you know, they should be within a university environment that guarantees that objectivity that Andy was talking about. That's probably the only way for us to get by a lot of these deceptions that are going on in society in terms of, you know, phony science, right-wing science, left-wing science. I'm cutting out some of my left-wing friends here. I've got a lot of friends who work in left-wing, if I may use those overused terms, left and right wing, think tanks. But I think at this point, we probably need to consider these independent science agencies that don't have the objectivity, that don't have the independence. We shouldn't be depending upon them anymore. And unfortunately, it's only, specifically for the most part, people with an agenda who do depend upon them. So, once we solve that, then, now, we need to consider, I already covered that point with climate. So, yeah, and my colleagues covered so much here. I'm already on page 4. I'm just about done. We're going to have some extra time for questions. So I want you to maybe talk to, you know, your friends who are in politics. Pass the message along. We truly, I think, have a difficult time now. I mean, I pushed for water for 20 years on the University of Lethbridge campus. For 10 of those years, I was all by myself, pretty much. There was a few other people dabbled in water. Some of the biologists touched on it sometimes, you know, when they got away from plant breeding. But, you know, until we went and really pushed water, I went to the Board of Governors in 1998 and made a presentation and said, we need to get on this agenda. And 2008, we have a water and environmental science building. And I think that's worth a round of applause, please, for everybody. Had I known it was going to be 20 years, I don't know if I would have hung it out, because, you know, it's been a long grind. So we, you know, some things are happening, but there's so many things that aren't happening, or so many things that are taking so long. And I want to leave you with a few notes about water now, because we're still working in a corporate agenda or in an interest group agenda. Essentially, if some of you want water in southern Alberta beyond what's on the table, you have to buy it. We don't know how much it costs, but we know it's gone. Everything's allocated, and they won't give out any more licenses. My understanding through the grapevine, talking to a lawyer friend of mine in Calgary, is that one of the going prices where somebody really wanted it was $7,500 an acre foot. Now, I talked to one of my friends in California who's in water management down there, and he said, gee, our highest price right now is $500 an acre foot. So, you know, now, don't hold me exact on the numbers, but the point being that already in Alberta we've got a resource which is incredibly expensive, and it's just gone that way in a matter of a little more than months, just a couple of years. So we have to look at these resources. We have to look at what we've got. How much time? No time. Okay, we have to look at these resources, and maybe I think society has to take better control of all of these, and let's begin with universities and something that should belong really in the common good. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm sure you didn't mind a bit missing a couple of minutes of your lunch. So enjoy your lunch, and we'll be back at 1 o'clock for questions.